Welcome to the Beacon Broadcast from Beacon Baptist Church in Burlington, North Carolina, featuring expositional Bible teaching by Pastor Greg Barkman. If you'd like to correspond with the Beacon Broadcast, or if you wish to support this radio ministry, write to the Beacon Broadcast, Post Office Box 159, Alamance, North Carolina, 27201, or find us on the web at beaconbaptist.com. BeaconBaptist.com. The Beacon Broadcast is supported in part by the gifts of faithful listeners. Now, with today's message from God's Word, here is Greg Barkman.
Amazing Grace. Last Sunday, we examined the account in the last part of Acts chapter 23. Where the Apostle Paul was whisked away in the middle of the night into protective custody because of the plot of the Jews to assassinate him. It is indeed an exciting, incredible story, but it tells us that God was watching over Paul, protecting him until that time when God was ready to call him home. And until that time came, nobody and nothing could harm him. And what was true of the Apostle Paul is also true of you, my friend, if you are also a child of God. You recall that the escort, the Roman escort that took Paul from Jerusalem to Caesarea, was huge. It was 470-plus soldiers, 200-foot soldiers, 70 mounted cavalrymen, 200 light infantrymen, and they took Paul because his nephew had discovered, and we certainly would wonder how he discovered, but his nephew had discovered this plot of 40 Jewish assassins who said they would not eat or drink until they had killed Paul. And they tried to get the Sanhedrin to appeal for Paul's presence at the Sanhedrin, and their plan was to kill him on his way there. But God uncovered the plot. I'm really looking forward someday in heaven to finding out a few more details about how it was that this nephew came to overhear that plot, but that indeed was the case. And so the Roman officer in charge of Paul wrote an epistle to go with him to be carried to Caesarea, and it explained what was taking place, and Paul was whisked away in the middle of the night. It's quite an amazing story. We will read the last part of that in chapter 23, verse 31. Then the soldiers, as they had been commanded, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And the next day they left the horsemen to go on with him and return to the barracks. When they came to Caesarea, they had delivered the letter to the governor. They also presented Paul to him. And when the governor had read it, he asked what province he was from. And when he understood that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will hear you when your accusers have come." And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's Praetorium. So there it is. It is an exciting story indeed about God's care for his children, his protection that watches over us during our times of danger, his provision that provides what we need at every juncture in our life. It is a reminder of the sovereignty of God, who makes even the wrath of men to praise him and turns the heart of the king whithersoever he wills. Isn't this pretty amazing that Lysias, the Roman officer, would turn out to be a protector of the Christian statesman and missionary, the Apostle Paul? Isn't it amazing that Felix, the Roman governor, would turn out to be a protector for the Apostle Paul? But God is more than able to accomplish such things. We just need to trust him. God knows exactly how to take care of his children and how to bring his purposes to pass in our lives and in the lives of those around us. So that's where we were last Sunday, and today we continue on into chapter 24. Acts chapter 24 on this Sunday, May 29. Thank you for joining me, and thank you so much for your financial gifts that make teaching God's Word on this station possible. Well, now we're going to examine the first few verses of Acts chapter 29, and I hope to learn here how not to promote your cause. What we read here is how the Jews promoted their cause in trying to bring about Paul's destruction. And what the tactics they used will seem rather familiar to us. The details may differ, but you'll recognize the tactics as being the kinds of things you hear about in the news and see on television, read about in the newspaper. This is how things are usually done in this fallen world, but this is not the way that Christians ought to do things. What is taking place in chapter 24 is that the day of Paul's trial has come, and it wasn't delayed. It came quickly. And he's formally accused by the high priest and the elders through a well-trained attorney. The charges are by now familiar ones of sedition and schism and sacrilege, and there are also complaints of interference by Claudius Lysias, the Roman tribune, who had rescued Paul from the Jews in Jerusalem. And in advancing their cause, these men demonstrate the extent to which evil men will go to promote their own agenda. Here's how the account begins in Acts 24, verse 1. Now after 5 days, Ananias the high priest came down with the elders and a certain orator named Tertullus. These gave evidence to the governor against Paul. Consider, first of all, what difficulties the enemies of truth will go to in order to promote their cause. This is a sizable delegation that comes from Jerusalem to Caesarea. You'll probably remember that I read in my Bible that they went down, even though on a map they were going north. But that's the way you find every reference in the Bible that I know of to the city of Jerusalem. You always go up to Jerusalem when you're going there. You always go down from Jerusalem when you are going anyplace else. Jerusalem was at a place of high elevation. And it is a sizable delegation that consisted of the high priest, Ananias, and certain elders, some no doubt who were members of the Sanhedrin, both Sadducees and Pharisees, and particularly Sadducees. But there were also many members of the Sanhedrin who were not there, and conspicuously absent were the 40 conspirators who vowed not to eat or drink until they'd destroyed Paul, but they weren't there, nor were the Asian Jews who accused Paul of bringing a Gentile into the temple and started this whole uproar several days before. But this group came down from Jerusalem to Caesarea, which is a 70-mile journey. That is nothing to us. That's a sizable distance when you travel on foot or even on animals or even in a cart. And we don't have any indication that that's the way they traveled, but it's certainly possible. And Ananias, the high priest, is by now an old man. And this would have been difficult. It would not have been easy to make that journey, but the cause is important. And so they will go to virtually any ends in order to carry it out. You'll notice a reference to 5 days. Now, after 5 days, Ananias, the high priest, came down. That must be 5 days since Paul's arrest in the temple, because it's only a couple days after his arrival in Caesarea. But the Jews are willing to sustain virtually any difficulties in order to further their cause, and also to incur virtually any expenses. They have hired a, no doubt, high-priced attorney. After 5 days, Ananias, the high priest, came down with the elders and a certain orator named Tertullus. Tertullus is a Latin name, which means this man is very likely a Roman who is trained to practice law in Rome and is now practicing law in the Roman colonies. And he is a well-known orator. That's what he's called, a certain orator, a man who is skilled in rhetoric and public speaking. And he's brought down in order to prosecute this case for the Jews. He didn't come cheap. We're sure of that. He came at a hefty price. But, again, no expense spared in order to carry out this evil plan. I'm often amazed at how much expense and difficulty others will go to in our day to further their cause. I see some of the cults and to what extent they will go to get their message out. I notice sports fans and how much they're willing to do and spend in order to just go somewhere and watch their team and root for it. Some people are willing to travel across the country at their own expense on by airplane and rent cars and rent hotels and buy expensive tickets and all that just to follow a sports team and to root for that. And on it goes. And the point is that we who are Christians and have the most important message in all the world are sometimes very unwilling to go to any extra trouble, unwilling to go to any extra expense. We who understand the issues at stake, we who understand life after death, heaven and hell, and eternity, often act as if this truth is not all that important, while we see others around us who are pursuing either fantasies or falsehoods and acting as if that's the most important truth in all the universe. We can take a lesson from this and be shamed by this account in Acts chapter 24, as we see the Jews and their willingness to go to such great expense in order to further their cause. But not only the extent to which men will go, but the tactics that they will use. And it starts out with their flattery. This, of course, being done by their high-priced attorney. And when he was called upon, we read in verse 2, Tertullus began his accusation, saying, "Seeing that through you we enjoy great peace and prosperity, is being brought to this nation by your foresight, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Nevertheless, not to be tedious to you any further, I beg you to hear, by your courtesy, a few words from us." Well, well, well. Listen to what he's saying. "Seeing through you, we enjoy great peace and prosperity." This is nothing but blatant flattery, because it's actually not true. Great quietness? Hardly. All kinds of turmoil had taken place under the reign of Felix. There was the uprising of the Egyptian with 4,000 plus men, which was quashed by Felix. Throughout the reign of Felix, there was a steady stream of assassinations to avenge wrongs imagined or otherwise by Felix. Felix had crucified many Jews, some of them no doubt guilty of crimes and insurrection, but others that were only suspected. And he was widely known to be an acceptor of bribes. In fact, his reign was so corrupt that he was finally recalled by Nero, of all people, who's not exactly a paragon of virtue, in AD 59. But he reigned from AD 52 to 59, 7 years. And when this is taking place in Acts 24, it is AD 57, and he had been reigning 5 years. The description that is given of his reign by Tertullius is a bold-faced lie. It is a blatant fabrication. There's not a shred of truth in it when he says, seeing that through you we enjoy great peace and prosperity is being brought to this nation by your foresight. Hogwash and rubbish. But flattery is the way to get things done in this world. Now, remember what I started out with? I said we're going to learn in this passage how not to promote your cause. We're going to learn how it's usually done in this world, but how Christians ought not to do it. And I am concerned, as I'm sure you are, when I oftentimes see God's people trying to defend truth and various causes of righteousness in our world by using the very same tactics that the enemies of Christ and truth employ. And that is not honoring to God. You can see here the kinds of tactics that the enemies of Christ employ. And what we learn from that is what we should not do. Worthy deeds, Tertullius said, have been done by your foresight. Name one. He doesn't. He just makes the statement. It's a bunch of flattery. There's nothing of substance behind what he says. But he's appealing to things that the Romans were proud of and they patted themselves on the back for. They liked to be thought of as peacemakers, those who had brought peace to a large portion of the world. They were proud of what we call in history books today the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. But hadn't been a lot of it under the reign of Felix. And furthermore, they like to be thought of as benefactors, those who benefited the people over whom they ruled. They like to be thought of that way. Does this sound at all like any politicians we know in our day? They want people to look to them as their great benefactors, as the ones who give them privileges and advantages and benefits that only can be given by that particular person, and to love them for it and to praise them for it, and to, you'd be tempted to say, to worship them for it, though I don't hear anybody actually saying that, but you wonder if sometimes people think that. But what we see here are the fantasies of human government at large, because what we see working out here in this specific historical incidents in the Roman government is really just a portrait of what you see down through history of governments everywhere. But you need to keep in mind, dear friend, that governments can only do well those things that are assigned to them by God, and only then when they are looking to God for guidance. It is the responsibility of government to keep the peace, to protect it. That's assigned to them by God. It is the government's responsibility to maintain law and order. It is the government's responsibility, God-given responsibility, to protect life and property, to punish the evildoer and reward the righteous. But it's not the government's responsibility to be the general benefactor of all people, or to imagine itself the benefactor of all of the underprivileged people. That's not one of the responsibilities and duties that are assigned to government by God. And government doesn't do those things well. They do it at great expense, at great extravagance and with great waste of resources and growing corruption, the more resources are utilized to accomplish these things, but government doesn't do it well. Beyond the things that are assigned to government by God, everything else that government attempts to do and pats itself on the back for doing all turns out to be fantasy, and they almost inevitably, I would say inevitably, end up doing more harm than good. The intentions may be worthy and noble. They may want to do good. Only God knows the true motives of the heart. But wanting to do good, wanting to benefit the citizens, and being able to do it are two different things. But men believe what they want to believe. And so they will often accept this kind of flattery and fall for it. Proverbs 29:5 tells us that a man that flatters his neighbor spreads a net for his feet. That's what Tertullian's doing here for Felix. God's children shouldn't use these kinds of tactics. It's one thing to be gracious and kind in our speech, which is exactly what we ought to be. It's another thing to use flattery, which is telling things, describing benefits and characteristics that are frankly not true, just for the purpose of puffing up the pride of the person that we're trying to gain benefit from. Well, we move from that to the accusations which are lodged against Paul, and we read about these in verses 5 and 6. Tertullian goes on to say, "For we found this man a plague, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, and we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law." So what are the accusations against Paul? They are, number one, insurrection. Number two, that he was a leader of a cult. And number three, that he was the profaner of the Jewish temple. First of all, they accused him of insurrection. "We have found this man a plague," that's thrown in for free, "and a," here it is, "creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world." Well, that's quite a charge. Think about what you know about the life of the Apostle Paul as described in the book of Acts and also some of the history that's found in the epistles. And think about how much of that could possibly be true, how much of that, how much there is in the history that even hints at any of that. "A creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world." Isn't that amazing? But that's what they said. He is a pest. We found this man a plague, a pest, and a ringleader of sedition. Now that certainly got the attention of Felix. Even though it's blatantly untrue, that would be considered one of the most serious offenses in the Roman Empire. The one thing that Rome officially was particularly sensitive to was any hint of insurrection, of rebellion, of fomenting some overthrow, some public disturbance, and that's what they're accusing Paul of. He is guilty, said Tertullius, of insurrection. Furthermore, he accused him of being the leader of a cult, a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Hear the language? A ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Now, Rome controlled its religious environment. Rome was exceedingly tolerant and allowed multiple religions. They did not, like many governments down through history, attempt to make everybody under their control conform to one religion. Many times in history that has been thought to be necessary in order to maintain public peace and unity. You have to have everybody pursuing the same religion, or you can't have unity in your domain. Or so it has often been thought, and erroneously thought, but Rome had found out otherwise. They had come to realize that the best way to keep people from insurrection and dissent, serious dissent, was to allow them to practice their childhood religion, the religion that they were, the religion of their culture, their country, their nation, their community. And so as they conquered territories, they incorporated all of these religions into the official religions of Rome. But here's the thing. Even though they allowed amazing toleration and allowed hundreds of different religions in their empire, they did maintain a list of legal religions, and anyone that wasn't on the list was considered to be illegal. The word we have in English that comes from the Latin word for this is illicit. It was illicit. And what Tertullius is accusing Paul of is being the ringleader of an illicit religion. He is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. We don't hear that word very often in the Bible, Nazarenes. We have heard it in reference to Jesus Christ, that he was from Nazareth, and we know that this is a reference to followers of Jesus Christ, but what Tertullius is saying is, this is a new religion, it's not on your list, and he's a ringleader of it. So number one, he's guilty of insurrection. Number two, he is the leader of an illicit religion. And number three, he is the profaner of the Jewish temple. Verse 6, he even tried to profane the temple, and we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law. Rome had given the Jews a great deal of control. We would be tempted even to use the word sovereignty over their own temple. Again, in the interest of keeping the Roman peace, knowing how zealous the Jews were for their religion. So, if Paul had mounted in some kind of a large disorder related to the Jewish temple, that too would be a serious matter for Rome that was trying to keep the peace and keep things orderly in the temple in Jerusalem. And so the charges which Tertullius laid against Saul, or Paul, are pretty serious and would no doubt have raised the strong interest of Felix. We'll have to wait until next Sunday to see how this all turns out. Please join me then. Until then, good day. May God give you his eternal peace.